Well, good afternoon, everyone. If it looks like we're missing about half the congregation today, it's because the other half is up in Denver this morning. A lot of people up there, Beth Bradford, the Courthises, the Currys, McMasters, although I see they made it here for the, they came in for the memorial service, but not for services there. So good to see them here. Let's see, Don Davidson was there, Audrey Griffiths, so quite a few up there, but good to see a fairly good-sized crowd here today, too. Since we do have a couple of visitors with us, I thought I'd give a brief introduction to what we're doing. You're stepping into the middle of the movie here. Actually, maybe more like the first 7 or 8 minutes of the movie here, considering the time this is going to take. But for about a year and a half now, we've been doing a series of in-depth studies on the Gospels. And let's see, I believe Connie passed out a copy of that to you. We normally charge those to $10 for people who are not a part of our congregation, but since you're friends of the Sucklings, it'll be $20 for you. So, couldn't resist that, today we'll be continuing with our study here, picking it up again, kind of in the middle of the movie. If you have your copy of the Harmony with you, we'll be beginning on page 18. Here under the subheading, Jesus Heals Peter's Mother-in-Law and Many Others. And what I'm doing in these studies is going through a great deal of, those of you who know me know I've got a lot of interest in ancient culture and archaeology and so on, so I try to integrate a lot of that material into our studies of the Gospels, and it really adds, I liken it to an archaeological dig, because you can know what's happening on the surface that's written in the Gospels, but as you dig deeper into the culture and historical background of the day, there are many other layers and levels of understanding that are brought to light in that help us get a lot more out of what is written there for us. So that's what I'm trying to do in here. And at the end, draw some lessons and applications for us from these studies. So we have quite a bit of material to cover today, and I'll go ahead and get right into that, picking up where we left off last time, again on the bottom part of page 18. Now, as we covered the top part of page 18 last time, we talked about how Jesus healed a possessed man at the synagogue on the Sabbath morning there in Capernaum on the Sabbath day. And we discussed a great deal of what it meant when the Gospels tell us that Jesus had smicha. Smicha, a Hebrew word that means authority, specifically authority from God. Jesus was widely recognized as a great rabbi from God. Again, the gospel writers don't give us a lot of these details. They understood that other people would have known and understood that, but we're 2,000 years and many cultures removed from that. So we discussed that quite a bit, and we'll pick up today with what happens immediately after that, after they leave the synagogue there in Capernaum. We'll begin reading from Mark's account, which has the most detail here. So we'll pick it up here, and again, the title for today's message is The Gospels, Jesus Heals Peter's Mother-in-Law, Tours Galilee, and Heals a Leper. So those are the three sections we'll be covering. So beginning here in Mark 1, verse 29, Now as soon as they had come out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon Peter, and Andrew, his brother, with James and John. But Simon's wife's mother lay sick with a fever, and they told him about her at once. So he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she served them. Notice a couple of things here, some of the background here. Notice that Simon Peter has a wife and a mother-in-law. Clearly, if Peter had a wife and mother-in-law, he is married. Now, I've never been able to quite reconcile that with the beliefs of one major church, which thinks that Peter was the first pope and therefore celibate. I guess they haven't read this passage here in their Bible. But there is a clear conflict there. I'm not sure where that church got their belief in papal celibacy or priestly celibacy, but clearly they did not get it here from Mark. Excuse me just a minute while I adjust this. There we go. So it's not cutting off the top of that. So, verse 31, so he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she served them. So this is an immediate healing there by Jesus with no recovery period. She, from the wording of this, she immediately gets up, having been healed, and starts serving the other members there. the other people there, Jesus, Peter, James, John, any others who might have been with them. Notice, too, here that no sooner had Jesus healed her than what was she doing? She was up serving her guests there in the house. Jesus healed her, and what is her first thought, her first reaction to be given her health back? She gets up and serves people. We had a long series of sermons several months back about spiritual gifts and how the bottom line of those gifts, the reason that God gives us the gifts that he does, is for the purpose of serving and edifying and building the body that is the church. And here's a classic example of that, of someone with a great attitude and a great example of serving. She recognizes she's been given the gift of having her health back, and what does she do? She immediately gets up and starts serving her guests there. Continuing on with the account in verse 32, at evening when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city was gathered together at the door. City of Capernaum, based on its size, population density, is probably about 1,000 to 1,500 people. Fairly small town, maybe about four blocks north and south, and probably about 10 blocks east and west. So a lot of people crowded in here suddenly around Peter's house there at sunset. The whole city was gathered together at the door. Then he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him. So basically what we see here is that the miracles that Jesus performed that day could not be hidden. Nearly everybody would have come to the synagogue there on that Sabbath day and witnessed him healing the possessed man there that morning. And word would have quickly spread also of him healing Peter's mother-in-law of the fever. So word gets around. I think it's quite interesting there that who do they bring to him? Those who are demon-possessed. They'd obviously heard of him healing the demon-possessed man there that morning, and people who had family members, friends who were afflicted with that problem, bring them to Jesus to be healed, no doubt because of what he had of the miracle he had performed there earlier to that day. And also, no doubt, word of the healing of Peter's mother-in-law also got around. And all of those people then who were wanting healing would come there to him. Now, this is a very wonderful and exciting time, obviously, in Jesus Christ's ministry, but the bottom line is the end of the story is it's somewhat tragic and teaches us quite a bit about human nature. Because why were all the crowds coming to him that we read about here? Why were they coming? They were coming there not out of love for him or love for his message, but they were coming because of, to be blunt, what they could get from him. What they could get, how he could serve them, not how they could serve him. They wanted to use him, in other words. They wanted healing. They heard about this, they come to him for healing, what they can get out of him. And later, we find, much later in the story, but Jesus would tragically condemn them for that attitude because, as we'll see going through the Gospels, they see miracle after miracle after miracle performed there in these towns, the three towns where Jesus conducts most of his ministry, and yet they didn't believe, or at least did not believe to the point that it allowed them to change their lives, that belief. Let's turn over just to interject here, Luke 10, verse 13 through 15, and this is the story of what happens. This, again, is much later in the story. But notice what Jesus says here later on. He says, "Woe to you, Chorazin." Chorazin's one of the three cities with Capernaum and Bethsaida. Chorazin's about 2.5 miles uphill from Capernaum. "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida, about 5 miles away to the east. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon were notorious for their wickedness in Old Testament times. They were held up as a bad example by a number of the prophets. If the works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the judgment than for you." Because Chorazin and Bethsaida had seen Jesus' miracles and didn't believe. At least those people of Tyre and Sidon, these ancient bad examples, would have recognized that a miracle-working Messiah was among them, but they didn't. And then he says, and you, Capernaum, his own hometown there, his adopted hometown, you might say, who are exalted to heaven will be brought down to Hades, to the grave, for their lack of belief. So it's a very, very tragic ending to this that that we see in the long run that all of these miracles did not change the lives of those who witnessed the miracles. We tend to think, wow, if people could see miracles like that, surely they would believe. Surely they would understand this is the truth. Surely they would follow what God says. But the sad record is, no, they didn't. Even when Jesus Christ is right there among them. Why? Their motivations were wrong. They were in it for what they could get. And there's a lesson here for us as well, that if we are in this way of life, this belief system, only for what we can get from God, we're no better than they were. And odds are we're going to end up like them. We ought to be in it for the right motivation, which is to change our lives, to change our thinking, to change our hearts, and become like Jesus Christ in every way. Because if we're only in it for what we can get out of God, then we're going to end up like that. So there's a lesson there for us. One of the study questions that I sent out last night was, why did the people wait until evening to bring the sick, the injured, the demon-possessed, and so on to Jesus to be healed? Anybody know that? Know the answer to that? Yes, Tim. Yeah.
The culture of the day was Sabbath. Very ritual, legalistic posts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Precisely. Yeah, yeah. Notice they wait until sundown, after the sun has set. In Jewish thinking, it was sundown after Saturday when two stars or three stars appeared in the night sky. That three stars. I read it two different ways, so I'm not sure which is accurate. But yeah, three stars that define sundown. So they wait until they see the three stars, then they bring people in. They wanted to allow that extra leeway. It wasn't just when the sun went down behind the hills or horizon or whatever. They had to wait till three stars were visible in the night sky. Yes, Jerry.
When I was over in Israel the last time, our driver told us about a woman who, when she did her candles, her curtains started on fire on Saturday.
Oh, no.
And she took a bucket of can of water, threw it on, and put it fire out. She was kicked out of her home. She lost her husband, her children.
Oh, man.
Because that was working on
Saturday. Wow. Boy, yeah. And that's how... picky. It's a classic example of how picky some of these rules are. Some of the things similar to this, I've read that if your house was on fire on the Sabbath, this is written by these early in the first few centuries of this thereafter Christ, that if your house was on fire, you couldn't grab up your clothes and run out of the house with them, but you could put on all the clothes you could wear and walk out. That was acceptable. But if you picked them all up, that was carrying a burden. And the way this ties in with this practice is if to the Jews in their thinking of that day, a burden was defined as anything that weighed more than two dried figs. Now, I didn't have any dried figs in my house to weigh and measure how many ounces that is or whatever, but that was anything heavier than that was viewed as a burden. So, for instance, if one of your family members had to be carried about on a stretcher or even needed help walking by putting their arm around you or something, that was carrying a burden on the Sabbath. You could not do that. Therefore, people could not bring people on stretchers to Christ on the Sabbath day. They could not bring them, supported by the shoulders of others, because that is bearing an unnecessary burden. Now, I don't know how that applied in everyday life regarding the Sabbath, because you can't bring somebody to the synagogue like that. So maybe, I don't know, maybe they brought them there Friday afternoon and dumped them and left them there at the synagogue till after sundown. I don't know. That's probably the way it worked. I don't know. But this is how picky some of these things get. And Jesus has to set them straight on different occasions. It's good to see a couple of health professionals here, because I'm going to share some really, really interesting information here that ties into that. It's interesting that you can do this study yourself. Out of 40-something mentions of the Sabbath in the Gospels, a large number of those revolve around healings on the Sabbath, where Jesus is, you might say, getting in the face of people who had these misguided views and rules and regulations. They're not God's rules, not his regulations, but man-made rules about what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. Like Jerry was bringing out there, you know, kicked out of the synagogue because you threw water on part of your house that's on fire. It's how ludicrous some of this was. But so Jesus does set them an example, as he did that morning by casting the demon out of the demon-possessed man there. So we'll find later, as we go through the Gospels, many incidents of where he does heal on the Sabbath. So this is the background as to what is taking place here and why people wait until after sundown to bring people to Jesus to be healed. So we see that right at sundown, yeah, the crowds, you know, 1,000, 1,500 people or so, the whole town, comes there surrounding Peter's house there to bring all of these people with all kinds of afflictions to be healed. That had to be a Sabbath to be remembered with Jesus teaching with Smicha there in the synagogue that day, with casting the demon out of the man, with healing Peter's mother-in-law, and then the healings of all of these people brought there that evening. Several years ago, and this is why I mentioned the health professionals here, I went to a lecture given at an archaeological symposium by a man who was a medical doctor who gave up his medical practice to study biblical archaeology, wanted to become an archaeologist. I don't know if he was successful in that or not, but he had stopped his practice and was studying archaeology, and it's my understanding he's got a PhD in archaeology since then. But his lecture was fascinating because it was all about issues of health and healing and medical knowledge and sanitation in the biblical periods there. A lot of fascinating information, but the one thing that really struck me was he said that based on scripture, on archaeological evidence, on other writings of the time, that he estimated that between 1 in 5 and 1 in 10 people had some kind of chronic disease, affliction, crippling affliction, injury of the types that we see Jesus healing there. 1 out of 5 to 10 people. Now, the population of Capernaum estimated at 1,000 to 1,500 people. We're talking about maybe 100 to 300 people who are being brought there, if that percentage is true. And I think it is when we see how many people, how many miracles Jesus performs in the Gospels relating to healing there. So he may have had 100 to 300 people brought to him that evening for healing there. It's a staggeringly high number to think about that. It's staggering to think about just a problem in society that large, with the lack of medical knowledge and understanding about the causes of disease and illness, and much less the cure of that there. So I do think we see something like that reflected in the Gospels, and it helps us understand why there are so many times when Jesus heals people and people are coming to him, asking, begging to be healed. Moving on a little bit, Mark adds a detail here in this account Matthew adds an account that or detail that Mark and Luke don't, which is the prophecy from Isaiah about Jesus' healing. Matthew says, verse 16 of chapter 8, "When evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, 'He himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses.'" And this is quoting from Isaiah 53, verses 4 and 5, which says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed." And we read this every year at the Passover service, because we recognize the fact that Christ's sacrifice wasn't just his crucifixion, wasn't just being speared in the side and shedding his blood to wash away our sins. His sacrifice was much bigger than that. We know and understand that some of the reasons for the beating, for the scourging that he endured, the mocking and all of that, was because of this, to take on himself the healing aspect. It is through, as we read here, through his stripes that we are healed. Through that he took on himself in our place, that we can be healed there. So Matthew here tells us that these dramatic healings that we read about in the Gospels are a direct fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy here. And we see healing again and again and again in the Gospels, reflecting Jesus Christ's empathy, his compassion, and his love for other people. I'd also like to bring in a few details from archaeology here that are relevant to this story and help us understand perhaps a little better the truth, the accuracy of what we read about here in the Gospels. In an earlier study, I showed you photos of the restoration of the famous synagogue there in Capernaum. And if you go there, you can see this, made out of this beautiful white limestone. However, as I pointed out then, this synagogue actually dates to probably the 400s A.D. It was built after the synagogue that we read about right here in the first century events here. This, again, is made of white limestone. Most of the other buildings are made out of a dark grayish-brown black basalt, volcanic basalt. So it really sticks out. If you go to, if you are privileged to go to Capernaum, you can't miss this synagogue. It's roughly probably half again the size of this structure we're in right here. Very 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 large, just sticks out there with this brilliant white stone. However, in the 1960s, archaeologists started excavating underneath the floor in the foundations of the synagogue to see what was beneath it. And they found something quite fascinating. They found the remains of an earlier synagogue below it. And they found that this one, you can see these white limestone blocks of the picture we just looked at, built right directly on top of an earlier foundation of a synagogue that was built in the first century. And they know that because they've examined the potsherds, various coins that were found underneath the foundations, or in some cases literally embedded in the foundation, and found that, yes, these dated to the first century, and this dated to sometime in the 400s there. So what we have is a situation where this is the ruins of the synagogue in Capernaum that we just read about there. And sitting right directly on top of it is a limestone synagogue from the 400s. And this enables us to get a pretty good idea of what that synagogue would have looked like based on the remains that are found there. It would have looked like this. You can actually see in this, it's built on the basalt. This is the later synagogue architecture, but you can see it's built on this dark basalt foundation. And I've talked earlier about the educational methods and techniques and how the local synagogues also function as kind of a community center, a school as well, where the kids would come to learn and memorize Torah, the books of the Bible, and so on. And that's what this wing is off here to the side, was the synagogue school there, where the kids would come to learn their scriptures and so on. So, this is quite interesting, some of the insights we can get through archaeology. Yes, Tim. Tim's question: Do we know what happened to the first century synagogue? I would guess probably two things. There are no intact structures anywhere in that part of the country of Israel, and that's primarily due to two reasons. One is warfare. This was a part of the center of the revolt against the Romans in the late 60s, 70s AD. So the Romans kind of came in and just, as the Romans do, they would destroy anything that stood in their way. Might have been destroyed then. Also, this area is very prone to earthquakes. There's a number of earthquakes, even some that are mentioned in the Bible. And this is actually one way archaeologists date some of the ruins. If they have a pretty close idea within 50 or 60 years, earthquake damage in a structure is very easy to identify because things fall in a straight line, because the ground jerks in one direction or the other. It doesn't wiggle all around. That's our perception. But it moves in one straight line, so things like columns will all fall in a row. So you can tell that's earthquake destruction. So they're actually able to date some archaeological destruction levels to a specific year that this earthquake happened there. So it's actually a handy tool for dating. So this we don't know, because they're not going to go in and destroy the whole limestone synagogue to determine exactly how the early one was destroyed, but probably either by earthquake or by warfare, one or the other. That's typical of that area there. Again, there are no intact structures there because of the passage of time and earthquakes and warfare and that type of thing. Fires also would have been fairly common, although that wouldn't have destroyed a stone building like that. But wood structures, mud brick structures, yeah, fire was very common for destroying entire cities, like the Great Chicago Fire in the 1800s, where Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over a lantern in the barn and it burned down the city of Chicago. That type of thing we know happened in that time there, destroying entire cities. So interesting there. Any other questions? We're going to move on to another little. Yeah, feel free to raise your hands if you have any questions here. And I don't mind the questions. Gives me a chance to get a drink of water, too, as well. Let's notice another detail here. I want to bring in some more archaeology. Mark 1, verse 29. Notice what it says here. Now, as soon as they had come out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon Peter, and Andrew with James and John. What's this tell us? A little detail in passing, but it tells us that Peter's house is very close to the synagogue that we've just seen the ruins of. Now, this is quite interesting because in 1968, when archaeologists were excavating the ruins there of Capernaum, they found something very interesting. They found these particular remains, which are very easily identifiable in archaeology. This is an eight-sided structure, octagonal, and if you know anything about archaeology of the Middle East, any eight-sided structure is a church, Byzantine-era church, specifically from 300s on up to the Muslim conquest of the land there when they destroyed them all, turned a lot of them into mosques. But any eight-sided structure is a Byzantine-era church. So this one also had mosaic floors in it, which is also very typical of Byzantine-era churches. But they started digging beneath these ruins, and they found another church underneath this. It was about 100 years early, so somewhere in the 300s AD when it was built. Dug down below that, and they found a first century typical house for Capernaum in the first century there. But the first century house was a little bit different, had some unique characteristics that, to my knowledge, they've never found in any other first century house in all of Israel. It had a large center room, and I've talked before how houses would be built around a central courtyard. I assume this is what they're talking about, because that courtyard would serve as the kitchen, as the rec room, as the living room, as the den. It was kind of the all-purpose room where people would conduct their household activities. But what was unique about this room is it had the walls and the floor of it. Normally, a courtyard like that doesn't have plastered floors. These walls and the floor had been plastered multiple times. And as archaeologists found these fragments of plaster, they discovered more than 150 inscriptions, not complete necessarily, but written in a lot of languages, written in Greek, written in Latin, written in Hebrew, written in Aramaic there. And these later two churches were built right over the central room of this house, right literally on top of them there. Archaeologists concluded from this that somebody obviously thought that this was Peter's house. And therefore they built not one, but two churches on that exact spot, including one that's quite large, as we can see here. They concluded also that sometime, based on the archaeological evidence, sometime in the first century, that the original room had been enlarged and had been turned from a residential room into a kind of a community room where large numbers of people would have come in and gathered. And to find all of the inscriptions from various languages and so on shows that a lot of people were coming and visiting that specific room. They're starting in the first century and continuing on up until the 300s when the first church was built over that. So therefore, they conclude there that at least some people were very seriously thought that this house, that this was Peter's house, and these churches were built on top of it. Today, you can go there, and this is what you see. You see this kind of spaceship-looking structure over it, and this is another church. But to their credit, notice that it's on pillars, and it's elevated above those earlier ruins. And it actually has a glass floor in it, so you can come and you can peer over and look down at those earlier ruins that I showed you there. These right here. Now this is all covered with that new church, but you can look down through the floor and see that, which is commendable that they left that without destroying all of the earlier archaeological evidence there. So another point I would bring up here, you read about all these churches in Israel, the Holy Land, and so on, and most of them, things like John the Baptist blew his nose in this spot, so they built this shrine or church on it. That's about how ludicrous some of it gets. But you see dozens of these big churches, shrines, and remains of earlier churches put there in the Byzantine era. Most of them I don't put any stock in, that's the spot where it actually happened. However, this one I do think is probably an authentic spot, that this is probably the location of Peter's house. Not that makes it holy or anything, but from an archaeological standpoint, I think it's quite interesting. I think the Garden of Gethsemane is another site that is authentic. Others, I don't put any stock in at all, for the most part. Another interesting factor, if you look at the location of this house compared to the synagogue, and again, we read how they left the synagogue and immediately came to Peter's house. Notice the proximity. Here's this white limestone synagogue standing out among all the dark basalt, and here's the church. It's no more than 60, 70 yards, if that. So it would have taken them, a minute or less to walk from the synagogue to Peter's house, if that's what it is. Notice also, what is Peter's occupation? He's a fisherman with his brother Andrew. Notice where the shore is. It's even closer to the shore. Again, no more than 30, 40 yards there where their fishing boats would have been pulled out. So I do think, based on the archaeological evidence, this is probably the exact location of Peter's house there. So if you have the opportunity to visit there, I'd certainly recommend that you visit not just the synagogue, but also this, as well as wander around among these different ruins here as well. This kind of gives you an idea of how packed and close together the houses and so on were there in Capernaum. There you can see they're fairly small rooms and tightly packed together. And again, Capernaum is maybe about 4 blocks wide north and south and about 10 blocks east and west. These are some of the unexcavated ruins out in here and out here as well, stretching along the coast. So any questions before we leave this section and move on to the next topic? Okay, very good. Now we come to the next section. This will be fairly short, but it discusses Jesus touring Galilee with his early disciples there. Mark and Luke, you'll notice, actually place this as set the first part of the story the very next morning after Jesus has healed all of these people the night before. So that Saturday night, they bring all these people to Jesus to be healed. So now we pick up the story the very next morning after that. Mark 1, verse 35, we'll continue with Mark's account because he has more details. Now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, so he gets up well before dawn, what does Jesus do? He went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. And let's consider a few things about this, because there's some lessons here for us. Notice that Jesus awakens and goes out to a deserted place well before dawn so that he can spend what we would call quiet time with God, peaceful time with God. One reason, we've long said in the church, the best time to get your prayer in is early in the morning. And this is part of why we say this. This is Jesus Christ's example. What does he do? He gets up before the sun rises even, goes out to a deserted place, might have been an empty field, might have been an olive grove, we don't know, just some place where there's not distractions around, where there aren't people around to distract him. And there's a good lesson in this, because when is our perhaps our most productive time for communicating with God? Well, early in the morning, before the phone starts ringing, before you have to go off to work, before the emails start flooding your inbox, before you start watching the news or things like that. Take that time before your mind is filled with all of this clutter and distractions and all of that, and spend that quality time with God. That's what Jesus Christ did. That's his example for us. It's a very good lesson here for us as well. Don't let things sap away our attention and focus before we communicate and start our day communicating with God. That's what Jesus did. Notice here what happens, though, and we can probably identify with that. Verse 36. So he's out there praying in this solitary place, but the peace and quiet doesn't last long. And Simon, Peter, and those who were with him searched for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everybody is looking for you." And we can probably identify with that, because Jesus just doesn't get a break, as the saying goes. After all that he had done the previous day, starting with teaching in the synagogue, then healing the demon-possessed man and healing Peter's mother-in-law, and then maybe spending hours that evening healing all of these people, dozens, maybe hundreds brought to him. And then he gets up early in the morning to go away and have some peace and quiet. And what happens? They come and say, "Master, everybody's looking for you. What are you doing out here?" We can probably identify with that. But it is rather interesting that Jesus' response. What does he do after that? Continuing, verse 38, when they do find him, he said to them, "Well, let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, because for this purpose I have come forth." And he was preaching in their synagogues throughout all Galilee and casting out demons. So what does he do? He hears the call of human need. He recognizes his purpose, and he fulfills that. And so much for his quiet time, his peace and quiet there that he momentarily was able to enjoy there. That's just what he did. Human need called, and he went to answer that. So we see that again and again in the Gospels. He doesn't turn people away. He gives of himself to serve others and to answer the cry of human need. Let's talk just a little bit here briefly. He was preaching in their synagogues throughout all Galilee. This is also where archaeology is helpful. The synagogue in Capernaum that we looked at is not the only one archaeologists have found. Basically, any of the towns of the first century, they excavate there in Galilee, they find a synagogue, usually right smack dab in the middle of town. The town is built around it. It is the center of the community life there. Some of the towns I know of where they found synagogues are in Chorazin, about 2.5 miles uphill from there. Magdala, Mary Magdalene was from Magdala. That's where she gets that title. It's about 5-6 miles away on the west side along the shore. They just within the last 2 years have excavated a synagogue there. The towns, Tiberias, which is about 10 miles away on the shore, found a massive synagogue there. The town of Gamla, which is about 7 or 8 miles east of there, they found a very well-preserved synagogue there. So basically everywhere they dig, they find confirmation of this, that there are synagogues in every little town there in Galilee. So when Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk about Jesus preaching and teaching in all the synagogues around Galilee, every town had one. And that's where he goes to teach the people there and also perform a fair number of his miracles. Matthew adds another little interesting detail here in Matthew 4, verse 23 and 20 through 25. And Jesus went about all Galilee, as we just read, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. And what I want to focus in on here is verse 24. Then his fame went throughout all Syria. Where is Syria? Syria is up to the north of Galilee. And they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them. Now, as I noted in an earlier message a couple of months ago about why Jesus chose to settle in Capernaum, why Capernaum, of all places, I noted in there that a primary reason for that was because Capernaum was located on one of the ancient superhighways of the day, called the Via Maris. Via Maris, Latin for way of the sea, or road of the sea, there. And where did it go from Capernaum? Ran right by Capernaum, and which direction did it go? It went north. Where did it go? Into Syria. So, it's, as it says here, his fame went throughout all Syria. We never see a record of Jesus traveling to Syria, but since he chose as the place where he would center his ministry in Capernaum, he knows people are going to be traveling back and forth along that Via Maris, north and south, all the time, and consequently we see what it says here. His fame went throughout all Syria because of people traveling back and forth on this road. Word of mouth is going to spread his message, spread news of his miracles, spread news of his teaching all the way up into Syria. Let's continue on to the next verse here. Verse 25, great multitudes followed him from Galilee, which is the area around the Sea of Galilee, from Decapolis. We talked about that. The Decapolis means 10 cities in Greek. Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. Well, what's Matthew describing here? Here's a map I showed you earlier. Here's the Sea of Galilee, and Capernaum would have been just about right here. This is the Via Maris, the way of the sea. What about these other areas that are mentioned there? The Decapolis is this area just east of the Sea of Galilee and extending down in here and a little bit over the Jordan River. So that area, there was another major road that ran right up the Jordan Valley. This is the Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. Another road ran right along here and tied into the Via Maris up here not far from Capernaum. So actually what Matthew is describing here is kind of the road system, the communication system of the day. Because this road that ran down the Jordan River Valley touched on the cities of the Decapolis, went down and linked up with Jerusalem right about here, another road that ran that way. Judea is this whole area here, so the road in the Jordan River Valley went to Judea, as well as the Via Maris also went to Judea on the other side. And also beyond the Jordan, that's referring to this region over here below the Decapolis, but beyond the Jordan means it was on the east side of the Jordan River. So again, this highway here, which Jesus also traveled and tied into here. So through this highway system, which was the internet, you might say, of the day, the communication system, word of Jesus spreads to all of these other areas. Jesus uses the road system, the transportation system, the communication system of that day to help magnify the effect of his teaching and his miracles there. And this is reflected in what Matthew tells us here. It's not saying Jesus went to these areas. We have no record of him going to the Decapolis, for instance. But he knows by being located where he is, that word is going to spread there because of that. So that was a bit of a short section, but any questions on that? Yes, Tim. Yeah.
Is it safe to say that Christ wasn't just healing the Jews? He was healing people from Syria and the Catholics and the
Tim's comment is he healing non-Jews? Actually, there's some very specific passages. I'd prefer to address that question then, because there's one famous passage where there's a Phoenician woman and asked for healing for her daughter, I believe it is. And what does he say? So he was sent to the tribes of Israel, and is it right to take bread from the children's table and give it to the dogs? That sounds horribly insulting to us, but I'd prefer to address that a little bit later. There are clearly times when he does it, and he does it for a reason that we're going to talk about in the next section here that we're just getting to with the healing of the leper. He does it, but when he does it to make a specific point, which we'll talk about next here. But very, very good question. Any other questions before we move into that? Yes, Arthur.
What's the road on the east of the Jordan that he was talking about?
Yeah, Arthur's question was the road on the east of the Jordan, the King's Highway. I'm trying to remember exactly where the King's Highway. Actually, I believe it was, if I remember correctly, there was what was called the Ridge Route that ran through Jerusalem and Shechem and Samaria and a lot of these cities that we read about. It's called the Ridge Route because it ran along the central mountain range in Israel. The geography of Israel is you have the coastal plain here, and then foothills basically here just on this side of the Via Maris. The Via Maris ran along the plain, a nice level ground. Then you had a mountain ridge here, and Jerusalem sits right on the peak of that mountain ridge. That was called the Ridge Route, so you wouldn't have to cross in and out of all these valleys as you went there. You'd go to town along, kind of like the peak-to-peak highway up north of, out west of Denver. The King's Highway, if I remember correctly, ran kind of the equivalent, but over in what is today modern-day Jordan. It ran through Ammon, if I'm not mistaken, and there were cities of Moabite and Ammonite towns over there. It ultimately would have tied in somewhere up here into the Via Maris and on up, eventually all the way over to Babylon, over in modern-day Iraq there. So I think that's the case, but I'd have to look at another source to be sure. There were several parallel roads, and the roads were very important because if you've been to Israel, this part of the country is very, very mountainous, much like our foothills out here. And here, where do our roads run? They run either parallel to the mountains, or they follow the creeks and the rivers that go up into the mountains. It's just totally impractical to try to put a road in elsewhere, much less with the technology they had back then. So they're very practical about where they ran their roads. And that's why you see things specifically to Jesus' ministry about the areas that he goes. Well, he's following the roads there. That type of thing, as we just saw. That's how he helped get his word out. They're using that, again, that was the internet. That was not just the highway system, but it was the information, the communication system of the day as well. Any other questions, comments about that? Okay. We'll go ahead and move to the next part, which is about Jesus healing a leper. What is leprosy? In the Bible, I've mentioned this before, Hebrew is a fairly vocabulary poor language in comparison to English. There are about 150,000 words in biblical Hebrew compared to our English language, which has about 700,000 to 800,000 words. We have very specific words where Hebrew had general words with a range of meanings, and that's true of the Hebrew term translated leprosy. Could refer to any type of skin disease, from psoriasis, from rashes, all the way to full-blown leprosy. And there are at least three types of leprosy as well. So the Hebrew word, when we see leprosy in the Bible, it's translated from a word that can mean leprosy, but has a broader range of meanings as well. We'll talk about the full-blown leprosy as we know it today, because that is the topic of what we'll be covering next. It is evident from Leviticus 13 and 14, we'll read a little bit about this, that it's talking about different kinds of skin diseases as well. That's evident from reading through the chapter. But let's turn here, let's read a little bit from Leviticus 13. Again, this whole chapter is about what is called leprosy here. And notice what it says here. The Eternal said to Moses and Aaron, "When anyone has a swelling or a rash or a bright spot on his skin that may become an infectious skin disease, he must be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons who is a priest. The priest is to examine the sore on his skin, and if the hair in the sore has turned white and the sore appears to be more than skin deep, it is an infectious skin disease. When the priest examines him, he shall pronounce him ceremonially unclean." So what is the topic here? The topic here is infectious skin disease. We see that mentioned in here twice. That is the point of this chapter. It is talking about how you deal with infectious spreading skin diseases, how you identify that somebody has that affliction, and how you quarantine them. We're talking about 3,500 years ago when people had no idea of germs, bacteria, Leprosy is caused by a bacteria, viruses, things like that. They had no idea what caused these illnesses, other than disfavor with the gods or so on. That was usually what it's attributed to. Much less any way to cure them. They had no idea what a germ, virus, bacteria was, or antiseptics or things like that, penicillin, the many tools we have at our disposal today. So what we see here from this chapter, and again we won't read it, is that God sets in place a quarantine system to prevent the spread of diseases like this. And leprosy, I checked on this just to be sure I knew what I was talking about, and it was rather interesting that researchers to this day don't know exactly how leprosy is spread. This is from the World Health Organization website as of last night. I found that quite interesting. They're not sure whether it's spread by, for instance, sneezing and the vapor and mist that comes from that, or blowing your nose, or skin-to-skin contact, touching, shaking hands, whether it's spread by contaminated clothing. They don't know to this day the exact mode of transmission, but it's rather interesting. 3,500 years ago, God knew that it was spread by close person-to-person proximity there, and instituted quarantines to prevent the spread of leprosy and other similar diseases here. And as a result of that, we also see something interesting here, and that is that the priesthood served another function, which you might say is sort of like the National Health Service. They were the ones who would inspect somebody and determine if he had a communicable disease, and if so, would quarantine them until it was determined that they were no longer a danger to others. We see that spelled out in this chapter as well. Again, we won't read through this a lot, But leprosy was very brutal for people. What did leprosy do to the human body? This is a gory subject, and I'm going to show you some fairly gory pictures. There are others that are much more gory, but these are kind of toned down a bit. But we need to understand what a horrible disease this was and how it affected people if we are to understand the lessons that Jesus Christ is teaching us here and what we're going to read about next. Again, leprosy is caused by a bacteria. I skipped over a part here. One of the study questions I sent out was what were the biblical laws relating to a person with leprosy? This is later on in Leviticus 13. It tells us here the person with such an infectious disease must wear torn clothes, must let his hair be unkempt, not combed, not trimmed, in other words, cover the lower part of his face with a rag or cloth like this, and cry out, "Unclean, unclean," so that people would not come close to him and possibly become infected, him or her. As long as he has the infection, he remains unclean. He must live alone. He must live outside the camp. So here we see the quarantine aspect of it here. So the person had to do this. Again, they knew nothing about the causes or spread of diseases at that time, so people had to be isolated. And this is what life is like for a leper in first century Galilee or Judea. They had to wear torn clothes, unkempt hair, to visually identify to other people that they are carrying an infectious disease. That's the point of it. They had to cry out that they were unclean to warn people not to come near them. And they had to live this way so long as they had this disease. And they had no cure for it in that day. So what happened? What was the process of the disease in a human body? Well, first of all, various bumps and nodules would start forming on the person, often in the face, as we see here. They would grow. Eventually, in many cases, it would become so deformed in the face that you couldn't recognize it's a human being. That's what writings say of that. And this is a rather mild case, but it kind of gives you some idea of what leprosy would do to someone's face. These bumps or nodules would eventually become ulcers, open sores that would ooze and stink there and infect the clothing as you tried to cover them up or hide them. The person would also, it would attack the vocal cords. So the only way the person could talk would be in a hoarse whisper like this, because their vocal cords were infected by this as well. The hands and the feet in particular would develop these sores, with the result that eventually they would essentially rot off, to be blunt about it. We see this in a photo. Notice the man on the right side. Look at his hands. You see the stubs of fingers where parts of the fingers have literally decayed and fallen off. You see some in the feet as well. Eventually, if the person lives long enough, even entire hands and feet will fall off so that you're left with nothing but stumps there. This is the reality. This is the hideousness of this disease. And it was hideous, utterly hideous. Before the fingers fell off, the tendons would be affected and would tighten up so that you would be left with essentially claws rather than hands that were functional. So you would be deformed like this. Horrible, horrible disease. All of these symptoms here led to the view that somebody with leprosy was... The only way somebody could be afflicted that awfully was they were being directly punished by God. That was the view. Again, they didn't understand any of the causes or treatment of diseases back then. In other words, the person with leprosy had done something that was so evil, so ugly in God's sight that God is punishing them. Now, they did have the concept then that there were times that God punished people with affliction. You might think of David, for instance, all the trials he went through. They understood from things like that that, yes, sometimes we go through trials and afflictions and illness and disease to build character. That was something they thought and understood. However, leprosy was an exception to that in their minds. The only reason people got leprosy was because they were so evil that God hated them and God is punishing them. What does that do to a person's mind? If you're a leper, think about that. You were viewed as cursed because you're an enemy of God. Some of the rabbis of that time wrote that, for one thing, you were not allowed to come within 6 feet, 4 cubits, of somebody with leprosy, lest you become infected. If the wind were blowing from the leper toward you, you had to be at least 50 yards away from that person, lest the leprosy infect you as well. Some of the rabbis would not eat food that was sold in a stall where a leper had walked down the street. Some of the rabbis boasted of carrying rocks in the pockets of their robes to throw at lepers to keep them away, lest they become contaminated by the leper. That was the reality. You were physically tormented by this hideous disease, but you were also mentally tormented as well, because you were detested and despised so much and viewed as being cursed by God that eventually the effect it had on your mind is you come to see, to detest and despise yourself. There, you are viewed as the living dead. You're alive, but you're dead. You're waiting to die because there's no hope. You're not going to be cured. There's no cure for it. You're the living dead. So picture yourself, let's put ourselves in the sandals of this leper who comes to Jesus. He's a man wearing torn, ragged clothes, hasn't shaved, can't cut or comb his hair, has to cover his mouth and say, "Unclean, unclean," to anybody who comes near him. He has to live away from other people in quarantine, either by himself or perhaps in a leper colony with other lepers. Your skin is oozing, stinking with these open sores and wounds. And on top of that, nobody can touch you. If you're married, your husband or wife can't touch you. Your children can't touch you. If you're younger, a child, your parents can't touch you. Nobody can ever shake your hand. Nobody can ever pat your back. Nobody can ever give you a hug. You are literally an untouchable person. No one will touch you ever until the day you die. Again, that's why I say this is helpless, a helpless, hopeless situation. This is what it was like for a leper there. And because you were cut off from contact with other people, because you're quarantined, you can't go to the synagogue to worship God with the other people in your town. You can't go to the temple to offer your sacrifices when you have sinned to get right with God. So not only are you cut off from every other human being, your family, your friends, your parents, your children, you're cut off from God because you're not allowed to set foot in the synagogue or go to the temple to get right with God. This is why you're called the living dead. You're dead, but you're walking around waiting for the release of death. It's such a horrible situation, and they couldn't even commit suicide to escape this fate because that was violating God's commandment against murder. So you might want to die, you might want to take your life, but you can't even do that. You're forced into this hopeless and helpless situation. You're anonymous. Nobody cares about you. And this is the situation. Pretty graphic, and I hope I haven't disturbed you about it, but we need to understand what this is like to get the point of the story of what Jesus does with this man. This is the reality. So let's read about it now. Mark 1, verses 40 through 45. Now a leper came to him, to Jesus, imploring him, kneeling down, or putting his face to the ground, as one of the other writers says, I believe it's Luke, and saying to him, notice how this is worded. He doesn't even come out and ask Jesus to heal him. He says, if you are willing, Master, Luke adds the word Master, Master, if you are willing, you can make me clean. But apparently he has the humility to not even come out, or maybe it's the self-image, he doesn't even ask Jesus directly for healing. He says, Master, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Then Jesus does something totally unexpected. Luke adds the detail that this man was full of leprosy. And Luke, being a physician, knows what he's talking about. That's a term some people believe that this meant that the man is so covered with leprosy that he's going to die fairly soon from it. And that is the ultimate fate of those with leprosy. It is ultimately fatal there if you don't die of something else first. So this man is full of leprosy. He's probably hideously deformed, barely recognizable. A wreck of a man. Probably looked horrible. And then Jesus does something that is utterly unthinkable in that culture and would have totally shocked anybody who saw it. Verse 41. Then Jesus, moved with compassion, stretched out his hand and touched him. Touched this hideous wreck of a human being. Touched him for the first time in how many years? Again, the rule was you couldn't come within 6 feet of the man. Jesus could have healed him from 6 feet away. We read earlier in the Gospels, he healed a son of a nobleman in Capernaum when he's up at Cana, which is 25 miles away. He heals a man's son 25 miles away. So it's no problem for Jesus to heal somebody who's standing there 6 feet away. But Jesus breaks that 6 foot barrier and reaches out and touches the man. Now, what did that mean in that society? Well, for one thing, it meant you immediately became unclean yourself. It immediately meant that you touch a leper, you're going to contract leprosy yourself. So as far as the disciples who were there, as far as the other people standing around, oh no, Jesus touched the man. Jesus is unclean. Jesus has just contracted leprosy. What's going on here? But they look and they see the man who suddenly his flesh becomes soft as a baby's bottom, as the old saying goes. The leprosy leaves him. And it's totally gone, totally cleared up. Where did the leprosy go? Did it go to Jesus? Well, in a sense it did, because by his stripes we are healed. He ultimately took that punishment on himself for that healing. That and every other sickness and illness we're healed from. But yet Jesus is standing there. He's not leprous either. Where did the leprosy go? What's happened? What's going on here? All of our life, we as disciples have heard you can't go within 6 feet of a leper, or you're going to get leprosy yourself. You're going to become unclean. And yet Jesus does that. Does something that is totally unthinkable for the people of that day and that culture. Everybody knew you just didn't do that. You just didn't touch a leper. You put your life and health at risk. But notice verse 42, as soon as Jesus said, let me go back to verse 41. Then Jesus, moved with compassion, that's his motivation, stretched out his hand and touched him and said, "I am willing, be cleansed." And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed, standing there pure and clean again, no longer leprous. And then Jesus tells the man to do something. We read about that in verse 43. And Jesus strictly warned him and sent him away at once and said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer for your cleansing those things which Moses commanded as a testimony to them." However, he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the matter so that Jesus could no longer openly enter the city, but was outside in deserted places. And they came to him from every direction. So what is going on here? This raises a couple of questions here. Two in particular. One of them I sent out as a study question last night. Why did Jesus tell the leper not to tell anybody of this miracle? We see this happen in various of Jesus Christ's miracles. Sometimes he tells people to go and tell everybody about it. Sometimes he tells them, don't tell anybody else about it. What's going on here? Well, as we talked about in the sermon on the background of Galilee a couple of months ago, there are a number of different cultures and religious groups and ideologies there in Galilee. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's Capernaum right here. Chorazin, Bethsaida here. This area, this quadrant, is filled with religious Jews there, the Pharisees. That's why there's so many Pharisees around there. These are Bible-believing, observant Jews. Down here around Tiberias are the people called the Herodians, those who are the sympathizers, supporters of the dynasty of King Herod and his descendants. They're closely allied with the Romans. Down here you have the Samaritans, Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well here, who are mortal enemies of the Jews here. Over here in the cities of the Decapolis you have the pagans, those who adopted Greco-Roman paganism. Worship of Zeus and all the other gods and goddesses and all of that. But up here you have another group of very religious, super religious, patriotic Jews called the Zealots. One of Jesus' disciples is Simon the Zealot. He's a part of this group. What are the Zealots wanting to do? What is behind them? What is their motivation? They want to drive the Romans out and establish a theocracy. They want to restore the kingdom of David there. They want to kick out the Romans and have Jewish rule over a Jewish homeland there. Let's notice an interesting passage. And I think this is key to understanding why Jesus tells the leper, don't tell anybody about this healing. I think this is why it happens a number of times where Jesus says this. We're not told which city it is. Luke just says it was a certain city. It doesn't name which city it is. However, it's clearly there in Galilee. So we have, this area of the Zealot territory is only no more than about 5 or 6 miles from Capernaum here. And so let's notice Luke 6, verses 14 and 15. This is after one of the miracles of the multiplying of the bread and fishes. And notice what happens. Then those men who had witnessed this miracle, when they had seen the sign, the miracle that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. What we see here is that Jesus is plainly in zealot territory. The lines weren't necessarily, you know, delineated like a state border or national border or anything. There was intermixture there. But there's obviously so many zealots here that they see Jesus performing miracles of multiplying bread and fish to feed thousands of people, and they think, hey, you know what? You know who we need as a general? This guy Jesus. Think of the logistical advantages of that. Having a general, a king, a ruler who can feed an army off a basket of loaves and fish. What about, you know, he's a miracle worker. He can heal the sick. If one of our guys gets wounded in battle, just raise him up and send him right back into battle again. Yeah, no wonder they wanted Jesus to be a king. No wonder they wanted to take him by force and make him king, make him leader of their zealot movement to overthrow the Romans and kick them out of there. That's the underlying subtext we see when Jesus sometimes tells people to tell others about his miracles, and the times when he says, don't tell everybody, because this is what's going to happen. And indeed, this is exactly what happened about 45 years later when, in this area of the zealot territory, a huge revolt broke out by the zealots against the Romans, 66 to 70 AD, and it led to Masada, if you're familiar with those events, led to the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple and the ending of that Jewish nation there. So eventually this happened, but we're seeing some of the early formation of this movement of the zealots there, underlying the text that we read there in the Gospels. That's the background of what's going on here. And we see this very clearly brought out in here. There are people who want to make Jesus a king. And that's why he tells a leper, don't tell others about this. One of the other study questions they sent out is, why did Jesus not allow the demons to speak when he cast them out earlier? Same reason. Go back and read the account there. Yeah, what were the demons saying here? The bottom of page 18. You are the Christ, this is the Messiah. You are the Messiah, the Son of God. There. So, yeah, Jesus doesn't want a bunch of demons or demon-possessed people running around loud and clear proclaiming that he is the Messiah. Because what's that going to do? It's going to attract the attention of the zealots, and they're going to get all excited and want to start this rebellion, which does, again, take place a few decades later. So this is what is going on, why sometimes Jesus tells people to tell others about his healing, and other times he says, don't tell anybody. This is what is going on in the background there. Now, another question that I sent out last night is why did Jesus, as we read here, tell the man to go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing those things which Moses commanded, the sacrifices for a healed leper? Why did he do that? Well, first of all, it was the law. There we read about that back there in Leviticus 13 and 14. But if you think about it deeper than this, considering what I've discussed about the status, the situation of a leper in Jewish society, the man needed more than just healing. Healing was only part of it. Because until he went to visit a priest and was certified as clean, and the priest would literally write out a certificate that says, you know, this is Zechariah the priest, and I certify that you know, Yochanan here is clean and no longer leprous. And he could then rejoin the community, rejoin his family, rejoin the synagogue, come to the temple to offer sacrifices again, and get right with the community and with his family and with God under the system of the time. So healing is just the first step. He has to go through the other steps to be certified as clean by a priest. Jesus can't do that. He has to go to the priesthood to do that. As you can read there in Leviticus 13 and 14. So anyway, that is what is going on. That is why Jesus tells him to go to the priest, because that is the only way he can be restored to become a full and normal functioning member of society again. Jesus doesn't have the authority to do that. The priests do. So that's why he sends him to the priest there. But as we see here, however, the man in his enthusiasm goes out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the matter so that Jesus could no longer go back to that city, whatever this unnamed city is, but went out and laid low, to be blunt about it, went out to deserted places till the heat kind of, the fervor kind of dies down, or till the miracle becomes old news at that point. And then, yet even then, they came to him from every direction. So he still can't escape the crowds there that we see here. Another study question I sent out last night was regarding Acts 1 and verse 1. Let's take a look at this, talk about this for just a minute here. Acts is the second of Luke's story of Jesus in the early church, the first being the Gospel of Luke. How does he begin Acts, the book of Acts, the second part of his writings? The former account I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to do and teach. Why that wording? Why do and teach? Why not teach and do? That's the way we do it in our society today. We teach people first, then expect them to go out and do. What's the significance of that? What's the implications of that? Let's examine that for a minute. What was Jesus Christ's teaching method for his disciples? I've talked about some of this before, but he called them to follow him around 24/7, to eat with him, to drink with him, to sleep with him, to walk with him, to talk with him. Everything that he did, they were following him as a group, seeing and learning by example everything that he did. Not just what he taught, but what he did, how he lived, how he acted, what he did in different situations that he would encounter. And sometimes, that is what made that form of training. Today we would call it an apprenticeship. There, it's one thing to hear about how to do something. It's something else entirely different to actually do something with a master teaching you there right by your side and actively participating in it. It's a much more effective way to learn that way. And sometimes Jesus uses what we might call shock treatment on his disciples. Think about this example here. These are people who've grown up their entire lives thinking the rule is you don't go within 6 feet of a leper. You just don't do that. It's unheard of. You'd never do that. What does Jesus do? He uses shock treatment. Jesus could have talked to them hours on end about how we need to love lepers. Jesus gives them shock treatment by reaching out and touching a leper and violating everything that they thought they knew about lepers being cursed by God and about how you dealt with lepers. Again, a lot of rabbis threw rocks at the lepers. No, Jesus comes and reaches out and touches a man who's probably never been touched in years and restores him and heals him. It's shock treatment. And we find Jesus doing that a lot in his ministry, doing things that were unheard of. Having meals with tax collectors. We'll talk about the calling of Matthew here perhaps next time. I'm not sure if we'll squeeze it in. What was it like being a tax collector at that time? What was Matthew's background? He does something when he calls Matthew that shocks his disciples. He is constantly doing that, tearing down their worldview, their paradigms, you might say, that are adopted from all of these additional laws and regulations and man-made orders, dictates, not from God, but from man. And Jesus systematically tears those down, as we see here with this leper. It shows the man isn't cursed and hated by God, but Jesus loves him and heals him and restores him to the community, makes him whole again. Another point I want to mention here, and this ties in directly with this, you know, we're familiar with what Jesus, or Joshua in Hebrew as we would read it, or in Hebrew, Yeshua, means. It means God saves, or God's salvation. Yah, meaning God, Shua, or a variation of that, means saves. But this Hebrew root word for saves, I mentioned earlier, Hebrew has a broader range of meanings to their words. It means saves. You can look this up yourself. But it also has other shades of meaning here. It means, can mean helps. God helps. It can mean preserves. God preserves. It can mean delivers. God delivers. Or one that I think is particularly pertinent here, it can mean rescues. God rescues. God doesn't just save, He helps, He preserves, He delivers, He rescues. All of that is within the range of meanings there in the name Yeshua. God saves, God rescues, God helps, God delivers. Now, what does this mean? What are the implications for this? Did the leprous man need salvation? Part of God's name, or Jesus Christ's name, as we commonly understood it. You bet, absolutely. We all need salvation. That's why Christ is named that. God saves. But did the man need rescuing? You bet he did. What is his status in society? He is helpless. He is hopeless. He's doomed to a fate worse than death. He is the living dead. He doesn't need salvation so much as he needs to be rescued from this horrible situation that he's in. What does that mean for us? Well, sometimes people need to be rescued. Sometimes we need to be rescued from whatever circumstances we may have gotten ourselves into. So my point in this is Christ's name, God saves, means a lot more than that. He has more roles than just the King of our salvation, the source of our salvation. He is the God who helps, who preserves, who delivers, and who rescues us at times. And we see this a number of times in the Gospels as we'll go through these studies. Here we see a man who needed more than anything to be rescued. There are other people that he encounters who he rescues, brings them out of horrible situations so they can at least have some kind of semblance of normal life to even begin the path of salvation. He's in such sad shape. How does he even begin the process of salvation? He can't go to the synagogue. He can't go to the temple. He can't get right with God until he is rescued by Jesus Christ. And that is an important role that Jesus Christ plays. Yes, he is our Savior, but at times he is also our rescuer and our delivery. That's some food for thought for us to think about as we leave here today. I'd like to leave us with a few lessons or takeaways that we can learn from some of the things we've talked about today that teach us about God, that teach us about our condition, our human condition. Here are a few things, lessons that I wrote. I'll go through these fairly quickly. This one I just talked about. Jesus is our Savior, but he is also our rescuer in those times when we need to be rescued. Second point, we see this from the crowds coming to Jesus when he's trying to get some peace and quiet and alone time. Jesus never turns people away. He never turns people away. You know, that first Sabbath where he preaches with Smika there in the authority, he heals a demon-possessed man, he heals Peter's mother-in-law. He's looking forward to some peace and quiet, and as soon as sundown hits, the crowds come out, and for who knows, hours, he's there healing people that Saturday evening. Gets up in the morning to go away to enjoy some peace and quiet time with God, and what happens? Peter comes up, says, "Master, everybody's looking for you." And the crowds arrive, and we see that again and again in the Gospels there. So, but what's his reaction? He never turns people away. He never turns away from people. He will never turn away from us, from you and I, when we need him. He'll never do that. You know, we heard in the announcements today about several serious prayer requests of people who are in terminal conditions. Jesus never turns away from them. God never turns away from them. They probably will not be healed in this life. Does that mean God has turned away? No, God's promises of healing are sure, but he doesn't always heal when and where and how we want him to heal or answer our prayers. Will those individuals be healed? You bet. How are they going to be healed? They're going to be healed in a way far, far surpassing any healing they could experience in this life. Because if they're healed now and go on a few more years in this physical life, eventually something else is going to take their lives. No, they're going to be healed in the resurrection. As we talked about at Bob Stahl's memorial this morning, they're going to be healed in a resurrection when they are given bodies that are glorious, glorified, that will never ache, never hurt, never wear out, never break down, never fail, never going to ache and hurt and deal with the pains and the suffering of this life. They're going to receive the ultimate healing. And they never turn away from us, Jesus Christ and God the Father. Another takeaway from this is that Jesus needed quiet, alone time to spend with his Heavenly Father, and so do we. We saw again that he went out and prayed early in the morning before all the distractions. So if Jesus needed this communication with his Heavenly Father, and Jesus is God in the flesh, how much does that say about how much we need that kind of contact and communication with God? Jesus also knew that he couldn't give out what he wasn't taking in. You know, how did he get that power for healing and so on? He needed to be close to that source of power and taking that power in, recharging his spiritual batteries, in other words, as we need to do by spending time alone with God. And how much more do we need to recharge our spiritual batteries? If Jesus needed it, being God in the flesh, how much more do we need it, being the weak human beings that we are? Another takeaway here, sometimes God is unpredictable when it comes to our expectations. This gets back to the point of touching the leper. You know, what were their expectations? This leper is cursed by God. That's why he's suffering so bad, because he's done something so horribly evil that God is punishing him. And Jesus blows away their expectations with shock treatment, reaches out and touches the leper and heals him. God the Father and Jesus Christ don't always operate within the limits of our expectations of them. They're not bound by that. Their thoughts, their ways are much higher than our thoughts and our ways there. And we need to keep that in mind. Another takeaway that applies to us, before our calling, we were like the leper. That was one of the study questions I sent out last night. Before our calling, we were like the leper, covered in sin, head to toe, and cut off from God, like lepers were then. Passage you might want to write down, Ephesians 2 and verse 12 from the NIV. Remember that at that time, you were separate from Christ before our calling, excluded from citizenship in Israel, the spiritual Israel of God's people, and foreigners to the covenants of the promise. And notice this last part, without hope and without God in the world. What was the status of that leper? Hopeless, helpless, cut off from man, cut off from God. And that's the situation we were in until God saw fit to call us and to reach out and to touch us and to heal us and to bring us to a right relationship with him, to give us that which we were lacking in our helpless state. Another point, six, is that God responds to those who want to be cleansed and seek him to be cleansed. That's what the leper did. He came seeking out Jesus Christ, came seeking out this rabbi. What? I talked earlier about how other rabbis typically treated lepers. They'd carry around a pocket full of rocks to throw at the lepers. Somehow this leper knew that Jesus is a very different rabbi. And he goes to him and not even asking, but he says, if you're willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus does, comes in a very humble attitude. Do we need to be cleansed? Do we need to be baptized? Do we want our sins that are covering us like the leprosy covered this leper washed away? Well, if you do, let's talk about it with me or one of the other elders here. A seventh and final point here is that God uses do and teach with us also. God uses do and teach with us also. Sometimes, in other words, we have to do to get the lesson. Sometimes we have to step out on faith, in other words, before we learn the lesson. It might be the Sabbath day. Someone has a job, somebody newly being called. They're working, you know, till 6 o'clock this time of year on Friday. Sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and step out on faith and do that, or going to the Feast of Tabernacles, keeping God's holy days. You have to ask off in faith and step out on faith to do things like that. Tithing, you know, surrendering 10% of our income there. for people. Sometimes we have to step out on faith and do so that God can teach us and ultimately reward us with the blessings or the lessons we need to learn from that. You know, many of us have been keeping the holy days for decades now. Are we learning more each year from the holy days? I hope we are, because God's Spirit within us should help us to grow in grace and knowledge and understanding. God's ways, as we see through these studies, are deeper and deeper and deeper into the understanding that He reveals to us in His Word there. And sometimes we have to step out in faith and put what we've learned into action so that He can use that to then teach us as we surrender our lives to Him. And no doubt there are many more examples, lessons we could draw from this. I just hit seven that stuck out to me here, but we are way out of time now, over time. And I apologize for that and for a bit of our late start here. But anyway, keep studying. We'll continue this on in, I believe, 2 weeks from today.